Good to see you all here this morning. I have no disclosures, no relationships to disclose of relevance to this talk. I think my colleagues before me nicely addressed the challenges that we're facing as well as presenting some strategies that we need in order to address these challenges. And I think we all are very aware of our demographic imperative. And what I'm hoping to do in my 10 minutes is really talk a little bit about how to build our capacity. How can we better work together? And I will be referring to this bookmark that many of you have on your seat. I have extra ones if you don't have one on your seat, and there's some more in the back. We are a group, as far as the Healthy Aging Research Network, that each of my colleagues actually has referred to before me, which is a thematic network of CDC prevention research centers. And we are in our second of our five-year funding cycle right now. We're a consortium of eight university-based member centers and community partners. And our primary purpose really is to conduct prevention research and promote the use of these practices proven to promote health. And here you'll see a picture of us in our last in-person meeting that we had at CDC. And I'll challenge you to see if you can't find some of the presenters here, as well as some of the people in the audience. So. This shows all our member centers. We're located throughout the United States, and we have wonderful geographical diversity there, as you can see from the location of the different HON member sites. We also do work very extensively with community partners, both locally, regionally, and nationally. These include AARP, they include the National Council on Aging, NCOA, which some of you may be familiar with, also includes Administration on Aging, Environmental Protection Agency. We work with different divisions within CDC, the Healthy Communities Program, the Division of Nutrition, Physical Activity, and Obesity. So although we are located in schools of public health throughout the United States, our work is really only done in partnership with our communities. Here's a listing of our main key competencies. We really focus on using research to really advance, and I would say is the three P's, which is practice, partners, and policies. So we're very interested in being down to earth and all the work that we're doing to really improve the work on the practice level. And we are always focused on policy, and again, we do this through our partners. We do have several key work groups in order to get the work done for the Healthy Aging Research Network. The work groups are related to environment and policy. They're related to the healthy brain, healthy nutrition, mobility, and then we also provide technical assistance. So although you're hearing only part of our work today related to the environmental policy, we are involved with a number of key aging issues. Overall, we provide technical assistance. We also do provide or conduct primary research, and then we also disseminate our work. And we do a lot of training initiatives, and that's what you'll hear a little bit from me. One of our efforts was to actually put on a research to practice conference series. I don't know how any of you attend them. Okay, a couple of you did. This was over the last 3 years. The first one was related to physical activity, and that was held in Seattle. The second one dealt with depression in older adults, and we were fortunate to have that in Atlanta at the Carter Presidential Center, and had Rosalind Carter actively engaged in it. As many of you may know, she's very involved in mental health issues. And then our last one was on promoting environmental and policy change to support healthy aging. And we held that at University of North Carolina. And we learned a lot from these conferences. We were very excited about them. We were able to reach over 600 attendees from these. And we really felt that it was a conference series that a large number of different sectors came. So we really moved out of public health, we moved out of our own disciplines, but we were able to move to both practitioners, researchers, and policy makers, and people from different fields. And we were able to secure funding so that we could provide a number of related initiatives, which we really felt was partly what helped contribute to this success. And I just show you these slides here because you can see Rosalind Carter in one of these photos. And again, very actively engaged. Another one of our keynote speakers was Larry Adelman, the executive producer for Unnatural Causes. Some of you may be familiar with that, the PBS documentary looking at racial and other inequities related to health. So having them engaged was very helpful. One of the reasons we felt that this was a model conference series is not only did we provide this two-day conference on these three different topics, but we were able to offer scholarships. So for people that would not otherwise have been able to come, we were able to invite them, pay for their registration, their travel, and that included both students but also other members, community partners who might not have the funding to attend. We focused a lot on action reporting. So not only did we have plenary sessions, but we had breakout groups where people really shared with each other about what they were planning to do. And I have this suitcase image here just to remind me to tell you the one story about when we were doing our mental health conference in Atlanta. And the very last session, we had participants voluntarily, and now there's 220 of them, report back what they were going to do. And Mrs. Carter was in attendance, and people were talking about how they had built new relationships, and they had some learned about some new strategies, and they were going to take them back with them. And I was particularly impressed because one physician from Oregon actually said, "I'm taking back a suitcase of hope." And it was very interesting that she felt, based on this conference and the networking, that she was bringing hope back to all the constituents and her patients that she was working with. We had a monograph that we produced from our first physical activity conference, and what we did is we captured the small group discussions. We captured them in a monograph, so all the participants really felt that they could contribute because we had this monograph that was one of our outcomes. We did develop some action briefs. Those are readily available on our HAN website. We also offered implementation packages. So again, I mentioned we do a lot of taking programs that have evidence base and bringing them into the communities. And we actually offered funding to help people move to the next step in order to do that. And then we also offered webinars in our depression series. And this was five different webinars. It was a new form of technology for us. And we were able to bring 700 people together over a series of five webinars. So you can start looking at what our reach was. But we were really then impressed with how webinars could really build capacity. And it led us then to our current initiative, which I'm going to use the terms EPC to refer to environmental and policy change. And so through funding from both CDC as well as AHRQ, we have now developed a four-month innovative online initiative. And this includes our old friendly webinars, but also presentations, building an online community, as well as we will be developing some action briefs. And we've been really excited. We're probably 6 weeks into our four-month series. We've had already 2,000 people come join us. We have two of our presenters here, Melissa and Margaret, who did a beautiful job. The main focus of our initiative really is looking at challenges that are amenable to environmental and policy change, the evidence that supports the specific approaches and outcomes, and promising strategies. So we really are moving it beyond just looking at the research and the evidence, but how can we really make this work in our practice communities? We're doing this in partnership with our colleagues, Creating Aging-Friendly Communities. And again, I mentioned that we do have funding. And we also have a resource guidance group, which is made up of a number of our colleagues, both at CDC and in different communities, to help guide us in our thinking here. This shows you one of the website, the web page. When you go in and register, it is all free. But you can see clearly, I don't know if you can see clearly, but we have our two modules up here listed already. We have a feature that's called Way Cool, which I'll talk to you in a little bit about. We have the cafe, which coming from Seattle and being friends with Starbucks is a particularly relevant logo there. And then we have some more information about the EPC series. So again, you can see that this is very inviting. We have four modules. So the way the four-month series is, we release a new module every month. And here you can see the variety of topics that we're dealing with, both looking at an overview for people that may be less familiar with the environment and policy change. We talk about optimal living environments. We focus particularly on mobility, and then we look at environmental issues. So for each of these modules rolled out September, October, November, December, and January, we have a key presentation. We then have a live webinar that then gets archived. We have an online community and then resources available. So it's sort of your one-stop shopping. It's all at agingfriendly.org, and that's on your bookmark there. And here you can see an example of one of our online presentations. This is from Dick Duncan. His background actually is in planning. He's worked a lot with universal design. And he gave a presentation on optimal living environments for healthy aging. Very fascinating. He really challenges us as far as looking at a paradigm shift. So I encourage you to go in and sort of see what he has to say. This is a sampling of people in the chat room. Again, you can look at the diversity of people who we've been able to attract in our first 6 weeks. I guess it's two months. But with 2,000 people, we have anywhere from students, we have staff from sustainable housing groups, we have informational specialists from the National Center on Physical Activity and Disability, we have health educators, program coordinators, a physician. So you can look at people involved in both the local, regional, and national level. So we invite them all to come in into our cafe, introduce themselves, and say a little bit about what their interests are in environmental and policy change. And here are some comments. Here's someone from Canada, where you can see that they're very interested in connecting with like-minded people. And it was all, you know, through coming on the computer. No one had to pay registration or go through the airport. And you can see how she's interested in looking at maintaining and fostering environments. You have someone else who's working in Hamilton County who's very interested in falls. So a number of diverse interests, diverse sectors represented, all interested in healthy aging and environmental policy change. As part of this initiative, we're real pleased to also present a clearinghouse, Environmental Policy Change Clearinghouse. Again, this is all accessible on agingfriendly.org website. And this is a searchable database of resources, tools, and strategies to support efforts in environmental policy change for healthy aging, with a primary focus on mobility. And again, we're appreciative for CDC for funding, as well as we have funding from AHRQ on this. It's really exciting because these are the resources that you can use in your communities. They're relevant, and again, it cuts across different sectors of aging services, public health, planning, architect, engineering, recreation, transportation, and healthcare. So again, a number of people have contributed to this. These resources are all free, available to you to download. We have a leadership team that has identified these resources. We have a librarian who's helped also locate them. And then we have a resource guidance group that has gone through the screening of each of these resources. So again, these are all available on the website. They're free. I encourage you to take back extra bookmarks to your colleagues so they too can utilize these resources. And it will be a growing clearinghouse. So as we become more familiar with resources, we would add to that. Another feature that just started with our initiative is, and this is thanks to Becky's use of the term way cool, is this is way cool things that are happening in your community. And we invite people not only to join us on the webinars and the presentations, not only to introduce themselves in the UPC Cafe, but we invite them to tell us about some of their tools, some of their programs, some of their policies that they're working at, and to share that with each other on the website. And so we've started to get those. Those are available for you to see, too, as far as different tools that are available that are way cool. So we clearly see momentum building in this area. Again, building on the work that both Kathy, Bill, and Becky have presented, the challenges and the strategies, we really are challenged now to build capacity. And that's for each of you and those that you go and work with in your home environments. So we do feel that the EPC initiative is contributing to building stakeholder capacity to better design, implement, and evaluate environmental policy change. And so those are several resources there. You can access us at agingfriendly.org. I am also leaving you here the URL for the Healthy Aging Research Network. And again, I have extra bookmarks. I realize some of you will be going back and reporting to your colleagues. This might be something nice, lightweight, that you could take home to them. And we hope that it serves your needs. There's my acknowledgments, and thank you very much.
And then I'm going to open up some, just making some remarks as the discussant, and then open that up to all of you to have comments. One of the things I wanted to do when I was thinking about these presentations and reviewing them, and really these ideas, I wanted to kind of go back to the model that Becky had said. And one of the things I think about from really from being from CDC and thinking about measurement, surveillance systems, what are we doing in terms of, we have done a lot at the individual level in looking at behavioral risk factor surveillance. We really know much more about that in terms of some of the relationships issues, and we're starting to develop quite a bit in the community. But I think it's that community, societal levels that really we have a lot more work to do. And I think there's some exciting initiatives when I think about some of the measurements. One, we need to say who's really impacted by these policies. How do we begin, as Bill had raised and all of the presenters had raised, about who do we know who's impacted by these? How do we know about the effectiveness of these kinds of programs? Who's left out or maybe negatively affected by having certain policies? And particularly Becky was talking about accessibilities and social justice. How do these programs get implemented? I think we know a lot about policies, but environment we probably know less about, and some of the adopters, and then issues of maintenance. And the other piece then I wanted to sort of thinking about is we now have these sort of pyramids in thinking about that we need to be thinking about the socioeconomic factors, the changing the context. And again, we need sort of a framework. This lays out that yes, we do need to be thinking about all these levels of intervention, beginning to identify them, but we also need that framework then for thinking about that. And so while I was thinking about that, I thought, how many of you are familiar with the REAIM framework? And when we think about REAIM, it really addresses those questions of reach, effectiveness, adaptation, implementation, and maintenance. And so when I was thinking about that, I thought, you know, we have a REAIM framework that's very much, and actually the, one of the things the CDC Healthy Aging Research Network has done very effectively is in terms of some of individual and group, is really using the REAIM framework to have a common language. And I think that's a very important one in evidence-based programs that we begin to develop in a lot of interventions targeted at individuals and sort of groups. You know, there's REAIM has been used as a policy intervention in thinking about how to do that. But really what I hadn't seen was really REAIM used as sort of environmental aspects of that. And so I was sitting there thinking about how do we really go about beginning to broaden this. We used it really in the caregiving world to begin to think about policy change. And so I thought, wouldn't it be wonderful to really see REAIM again as across all of these levels be adapted for that? And so I was reading my American Journal of Public Health on the way out on the airplane, and what did I find? But an article on reaiming REAIM, which is using the model to plan, implement, and evaluate the effects of environmental change approaches to enhancing population health. And the first author is here, and that is Diane King, working with Russ Glasgow, and really looking at this REAIM framework. And so in my discussion remarks, I really wanted to say, I think, again, this common language across all of these levels and dimensions will do us, I think, a great deal of good of how do we begin to, again, articulate across working, again, not only within the policy environmental, but in all across all of these evidence bases. So again, that's, I just wanted to open that up for discussion and open it up to all of you for questions. And thank you. Yes. Yes.
My name is Jake Paul. I'm the person representing the APHA on several national committees dealing with built environment issues. I'm also the author of three policies on this that APHA adopted, the latest being 2009-13 on use of building codes and standards for environment. And it mentions that universal design and calls for visitability. I'm going to say some things that are rather critical, and I'm known for this. And last night I received strategic error to focus only on falls among the elderly. I'll give you an example. Stair-related falls in homes that result in hospital admission have both increased by about 125% over the last 10 years for both the under 65 and over 65. So there are demographic changes which are very profound affecting people under 65. So many of these programs are flawed from that perspective. They're also flawed because there's almost no link between the people who do these programs and the people who do the falls work at the biomechanics ergonomics level. I'm involved with them as well as the other groups. And this troubles me because some of what's called evidence-based within the falls prevention programs actually make the problem worse, including some advice given in virtually all the fall prevention programs for older people what they should do in their homes. And I'm deeply troubled by this because what this means is that some of what you're recommending is actually harming the problem falls, even though some of the other things may be helping. And because you only do gross statistics, you don't know what the effect is of the bad advice versus the good advice.
Can you give one example?
Yes. The prime example, area rugs. The standard recommendation is either to remove them or to tape them down. And to tape them down is a complete misunderstanding of what the fall dynamics are, because the problem with misstep mode is a trip, not a slip. And for older people, slipping on an area rug is virtually impossible, but a trip is highly likely, and it's increased even more when you tape it down. So that's an example of some advice that is causing more injuries rather than fewer injuries. Very common in many documents. I'll just close by saying that the conference next summer on stairway usability and safety, it's a two-day conference, will address all of these factors from all the perspectives, including programs like this and the basic ergonomics or biomechanics. And if you want some information on that, I'll put a handout in the back on a package that's currently available on stairways, but it has my contact information on it. And so I would urge a very careful re-examination of the strategic aspects of what you're doing and the tactical aspects, because they are causing problems. And the statistics on falls are devastating, absolutely devastating, and they've been going up for the last 10 years. Look very carefully at that policy 2009-13, because it gives a lot of the background to this, and I put a lot of work into it. I'll end by saying that on the visitability front, it's ironic that Eleanor Smith, who many of you know, I had to pay her way to a recent hearing in New Orleans to get visitability into one of the national building codes in the U.S. She has been trying for years to get help from CDC, and she hasn't gotten it. She lives in Atlanta. So the irony is that here we have the world's best proponent on visitability, can't get support from CDC, and I, as a private individual, have to support her travel to the meeting. So some things to think about. So I'm sorry I'm critical about this, but after 43 years of looking at this kind of stuff, I really have to be. Sorry.
Well, and I think your points are well taken. One of the things that in this group that's talking about is sort of raising again to that higher sort of policy and strategy levels. And again, I think one of the things in the Healthy Aging Program, we work closely with the Injury Center, who is really looking at some of the falls work. And we're not in the Healthy Aging Program particularly, you know, looking at those specific kinds of programs. But again, I'll look at these pieces and bring those back and talk about some of those issues as well. And I think it is one of the reasons, I think we started looking again at these multiple kinds of levels of really trying to impact and think about sort of older adult issues. Again, I think the purpose of this seminar was to talk about the integration within some of those. And I am very familiar with Eleanor's work. She's hosted CDC, and she's been quite generous to talk to us about visitability. She's been involved in a number of things with EPA and supporting her travels and her integration. We have a CDC ARP liaison in which we've involved her in the visitability concepts and stuff. So, and again, she's been very successful for those here in Atlanta, really making a difference in the Habitat for Humanity of making all of those accessible. So I appreciate you raising her work, because she is an important figure really in this field. So thank you. And others?
Yeah. Oh, we should let others.
Yes.
Just one quick comment. I do appreciate the comment about being sensitive to having programs that clearly are singling out older populations. So similar thing happened with mobility devices or assistive devices for mobility and the stereotyping of individuals with that. I think Becky Hunter's comment about not specifically trying to always put it into a service that is unique to a population well taken here. Mm-hmm. And I think that's on the right track. I think when you build environmental settings that are good for one person with disabilities, that are also very good for older adults, so to some degree it's a catch-all. I just want to end up with one other minor point. You brought up something I hadn't thought through too much, none of us maybe had, and that is the naturally occurring study that could be done. We're looking at the person. Maybe we should be looking at how the environment changes people and whether or not, for instance, you talked about these maps. The real issue is not whether a map helps an individual walk in an area. How quickly would they have found that spot anyway in a naturally occurring environmental change compared to a map strategy?
Well, looking at maps would provide us an opportunity to actually do that kind of study.
Yes.
It gives us the flexibility to begin to develop an evidence base. So I think for strategic reasons and for scientific reasons, it's worthwhile to begin to pursue. And again, I want to emphasize, I'm not saying that we should only look at environmental adaptation and not consider environmental modification. It has to be done together.
The last point, though, is your comment about environmental ageism, I think, should be taken to the nth degree. Mm-hmm. There are occasions where we might be overdoing it or doing it to the point where it is making it not useful.
Good. And another question.
I was wondering on a couple of things. One on the adaptation issue. What you're describing sounds as innovative. Seems routine for the bicycle folks. Mm-hmm. The bike paths are always designed around barriers rather than moving barriers. So it's de rigueur in trying to develop a bike plan for a city. So this doesn't sound that innovative. I mean, I don't mean that criticism, I don't mean not innovative, but it doesn't sound new because city planners have been using this for the last 10 or 15 years. So is it that different? Or and then is there another example besides the map or the rerouting in that bigger issue that you raised?
Well, I think of the walking maps as kind of an exemplar. There may be other strategies as well. And I, at least for me, part of the appeal is that it is mundane and that it is something that perhaps can be readily implemented. But I'm also interested in this question of developing an evidence base for this work. I think a lot of the practices and policies that we implement make sense. They have an appeal, and they apparently do no harm. And for that reason, we're implementing it. But I think to think about it, the next generation of work in this area, I mean, what is this work going to look like in 50 years? And I think that if we're interested in trying to refine some of the practices and policies, we really need to begin to develop an evidence base. And I think that's one of the things that we should be doing in public health.
Can I just add to that, Bill, also, that I think that communities putting prevention to work that is actually assessing some of the impacts is an important area. The community guide has done a lot of evaluation and policy kinds of initiatives. So I think there's beginning to be those kinds of conversations, but I agree. I think it's one of the great challenges that need to
and
be really taken
evidence?
On. Right.
What is evidence in
and how
area?
Does you collect evidence for these kinds of reviews?
At what point do we act?
And then what we'll do is we'll take one more question, then we'll open it up where people can come up and talk to the panelists. Yes.
Have any of you, how much are all of you using the internet, the WHO document, International Classification of Functioning, because it fits right into all of your work, and are you incorporating that? That's my first question. The second question I have is for Rebecca, and one of your bullet points, you said older driver support, and I'm sort of curious to know a little more detail about what you mean by that. And then my third comment is simply to this gentleman, just a comment. I think one of the, interesting, as a clinician, physical therapist, and public health, but mostly clinical PT right now, with frail elderly for the last 20 years, I think we don't include the elders and the seniors and the older aging enough in our planning. Because as an experienced home care evaluator, the fact of the matter is we have to deal with reality. And reality is, just But there are people who want area rugs in their house, and they will have area rugs in their house no matter if they fall 10 or 15 times a year. So we need to involve the disability section is very big right now, and really including everybody in the planning. Nothing without us, nothing for us without us. And I think we need to remember that in the aging community. I mean, we do have elders and older aging who have dementia, but we still can include them in planning. And I think that that will offset some of the disadvantages that he is speaking of. And I think when researchers are off in their ivory tower making all these plans, and that's why policy change down at the level of partnerships with community. I'm just so excited. I just love this entire session. It was fabulous. I think there's a lot of interaction and common ground with disability. I'm hoping that next year we can do some co-sponsorship of sessions. So anyway, those are the other questions. But two quick questions about the elder driver support, older driver support, and the ICF.
And actually, we're putting together a special issue for the Journal of Aging Research, and ICF is our main framework. Tom Prohaska is our
person. And did you want to talk about the seminar next time? The forum? Do you want to talk about the forum?
Can I mention it? That
yes, please mention it. Real quickly, Ruth.
Next session is in... next session for the aging forum is on in similar issues, the built environment, and I invite everybody to come to that. It's in 708, I believe. Which is right next door, and we have a session today at 10:30, and we also have a session tomorrow, and they'll be carrying on conversations very similar to the excellent session that we just
did. Thank you for joining us this morning.